Hello, this is Janet Gallen welcoming you to Love Letters Live. And as our regular listeners know, this is a show about, it's not a show, this is a philosophy about love letters and why write them to people. They are for anyone at any time and for any reason that you have something positive to express, because taking gratitude to the grave serves nobody. Why not write it and stamp it and mail it and make somebody else's life happier? And these can be letters of romance and seduction and wooing and promises, welcoming people into your life, welcoming them out of your life gently and lovingly if you have to. It doesn't matter what the reason is. You have the reason. And you can turn that into some kind of compassionate and loving letter that will be really a treasure for someone to keep probably forever and be instructive generations down the line. I want to go to my guest today, John Welshens, who is a meditation teacher and the author of One Soul, One Love, and One Heart, The Sacred Path to Healing All Relationships. And John, I'm just going to go to you. You talk about what that book does, and maybe even start with you and why you came into this field.
Well, that's a long story, Janet, but
starts
back when I was 3 years old and I almost died from polio. And I think that I had a miraculous healing, and that gave me some insight that most children don't have.
Oh, I was going to say, even as a child, you had some kind of insight instead of letting it just pass as your natural state.
No, I think that my parents made an effort to make me remember.
Oh, good.
That something really significant had happened to me at a young age, and that I was extra lucky to be alive, mm-hmm. and to be as healthy as I am. Mm-hmm. And so that began an interest in spirituality.
Even as a child?
Mm-hmm. Even as a child.
Yeah, I'm always interested in that because I think there is such a thing as spiritual sophistication,
mm-hmm.
just like there are other talents.
Mm-hmm.
And may I ask when you were aware of that? At what age?
Well, I think probably I was sick at the age of 3. I think probably when I was about 5 or 6, mm-hmm. I started to become really aware, because what had happened was that my parents had been married by Norman Vincent Peale.
Oh.
And that's a whole other story.
That's a whole laughter of recognition.
But
yes, okay.
My father was very invested in the power of positive thinking,
yes.
and metaphysical Christianity and so on. And so when I got sick, the doctors had said the case was hopeless, but he said, "I'm not giving up."
Doctors are not supposed to say that, I thought.
Well, they know, but they do.
Oh, my. Okay.
Yeah. And so he got together with all of his friends and spiritual friends and family and business associates, and he asked that everybody pray in whatever tradition they practice. And after about 3 weeks of that, one night my dad had a vision of Jesus standing next to my bed and smiling. And he woke up and he said, "That's got to be good." And he ran and woke my mother up and said, "I think John is going to be all right."
Mm-hmm.
And 20 minutes later, there was a phone call from the hospital saying, "Mr. Welshens, there has been a miracle."
Oh, my goodness.
And my fever had broken, and I was awake, and I'd been in a coma for three weeks.
I was going to ask you, because polio can take various forms
mm-hmm.
of attack.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my.
And I had the form that attacked the respiratory system.
Uh-huh, I was going to ask you that. Yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So I had no lasting effects of that, really. I mean, just enough to remind me to be grateful.
And there are people, older people, still in iron lungs.
Right. Well, that was what my parents were told, was your son will either, there's a 99% chance he'll die. If he doesn't die, there's a 95% chance he'll be in an iron lung.
For the rest of his natural life, which
right.
could be a long, long time, can't it?
Right.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
It's so nice to see you here, so healthy and handsome.
Thank you.
Handsome doesn't count, but anyway, go ahead.
So that led me on a spiritual quest. Now, mm-hmm. another side to my parents was that they both had been very serious alcoholics before I was born.
Uh-huh.
And they had stopped drinking when I was born, but when I was 11, they started again.
Oh.
So we went from having a very happy home to having a nightmarish home, and that sort of turned me away from spiritual things, and I became sort of an agnostic, I think. I always thought there must be something that created this universe, but I wouldn't want to be in his or her shoes if I wouldn't want to be responsible for this mess. Later, when I was a teenager, I started to have some amazing mystical experiences, which began to lead me toward the spiritual path, and I got really interested in the teachings from India.
So if you think you can throw yourself off a path you're meant to be on...
I don't think you can.
You get dragged back. Don't you?
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, if you're lucky.
Yes.
If you're lucky.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I think you can, but I think also, you know, I've been very fortunate that I've had many times when I've been shown opportunities to really stray from the path, and something in me says, it's not a good idea.
Yeah, I'm interested in this because it's clearly what you're saying.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. But, you know, what led me to the point, what makes me different from somebody else who said, yeah, I'd like to go whoop it up, you know? I don't know. You know, it's very interesting to contemplate that. But then in 1976, over in Berkeley, I studied with Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. And the interesting experience...
You were just drawn to her.
I was drawn to her. I was drawn to, and I didn't.
What did
she
say for people who might not know who she is and what she does?
Sure. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross was a Swiss-born psychiatrist who, in the 1960s, was teaching at the University of Chicago Medical School. And through a variety of circumstances, she began to realize that Americans had a very strange relationship with death and with grief. Like death, we want to pretend it doesn't happen, and we shouldn't grieve if it does. And she thought that was completely bizarre, and decided that Americans needed help with this problem. And she initially wrote a book called On Death and Dying, which contained what became known as the five stages of grief or the five stages of dying. She was quite an extraordinary human being and probably was the single most powerful force that paved the way for the hospice movement in our country. The interesting thing to me was that when I studied with her, I didn't think I had any interest in counseling people who were dying and people who were grieving. But I was so touched by what she shared, and the essence of it that touched me so deeply was that it seemed that in the face of our own mortality, or the mortality of someone we love, that we finally wake up and start to realize how important relationships are. And we start to really pay attention. People asked me, I did a workshop in San Francisco yesterday, and someone asked, why did you write this book, One Soul, One Love, One Heart, about relationships? And I said, you know, it's really simple, the variety of reasons, but one of the primary influences was the recognition that everyone I've ever dealt with who was facing their own death was not concerned that they hadn't spent more time at the office or that they hadn't made more money. The things that troubled them at the end of their lives were the relationships that felt unhealed and the things that hadn't been said and the communications that hadn't been made and the healings that hadn't happened.
So what do you encourage? I mean, is this through this book, One Soul, One Love, One Heart, what is your focus? What do you want people to do?
Well, the book, it takes a much wider view and really starts from the premise that we're all one and then says, what does that mean? And how do we experience it in life? Because there's certainly a lot of people and things and situations we don't feel at one with. In fact, that's actually a very rare and precious experience, which is what we're looking for in relationships.
Wait, you're saying the precious experience is not feeling at one?
No.
Or feeling at one?
To feel at one.
Oh, that's what I thought. Then you said once in a while people don't. Okay.
Yeah. So well, because I think that for most of us, that feeling of oneness is a very rare experience.
Oh, I see. I thought you were going to say, this just shows how the mind can play tricks. I thought you were going to say that that not feeling is precious because then you get to heal it.
Well, you could look at it that way. Sure.
No, I want to look at it your way. Go ahead.
Well, you know, I look at it that way too. Yeah, because in essence, the other side of that, which you're alluding to, is that when we feel separate, we're not feeling the deepest part of our nature. Our true nature is we literally are all one.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can look at quantum physics and understand, I can't understand it, but I can see the theory behind scientifically how we're all one. And then I see that the highest spiritual paths are saying we're all one. So in essence, what we're doing in relationship is trying to get back into that oneness.
So how do, I understand that you counsel people in grieving.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you work this in?
Well,
what part does this play?
It plays a part in the sense that because we as a culture are habituated to understanding relationship in terms of me and the other person, and looking at another person in terms of how they fulfill what we perceive to be our needs,
mm-hmm.
which I usually like to say are really our desires, because
mm-hmm.
needs are very simple
mm-hmm.
for human beings.
You mean like air and
water and
yes.
food and
yes.
yeah.
Okay.
And so we are in this dynamic in relationship where we're always looking for something from someone else. And that's largely because our culture trains us that way. From the time we're children, we're trained to see that happiness comes from external things, from wealth, from possessions, from power, and so on.
Because along with those real needs, I mean, if people, if babies aren't touched, if we're not touched, and really, don't we shrivel and die?
That's a need.
Okay, so that counts in there, too.
Sure.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. However,
mm-hmm.
you know, I think, you know, part of what I'm saying, I'll jump ahead a little bit.
Please.
Because part of what I'm saying is that I can say what I say because I've seen so many people who have gone through experiences that most of us would consider unworkable. Experiences mm-hmm. that many people would say, if that happens to you, you'll be ruined for life.
I have a whole list of those, sure.
Mm-hmm. And yet, I don't think anyone is necessarily ruined for life because I think nothing can disturb the soul, the inner being, the inner light that we all have.
Well, I also think when you look at other people's difficulties
mm-hmm.
and you try to imagine what it would be like, it's not imaginable. That's how you get, I think, to that feeling.
Right.
But then when something happens to you, you deal with it.
You deal with it.
It's
exactly.
Mm-hmm.
You reach down and you
yes.
find the resources.
And that's what you help people do?
You didn't know you had. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And also to start to realize that the experience of love is inside us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, we fall in love with another human being,
mm-hmm.
and then we feel something we've never felt before. We think that they gave us something that we never had. And really, what's happened in that experience is they've allowed us to awaken to the place in ourselves where we are love. And it's so good, but we don't understand that it's inside us. We think it's in them, and then we start to get neurotic and frightened and say, well, I better know where you are all the time and who you're with,
because uh-huh.
I don't want you to give this experience to anybody else.
Selfish little scamp, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And so if you take that principle forward, you start to see that whether separation comes through divorce or death or whatever brings about a separation between people, that they really haven't lost the thing that they're really seeking in relationship, which is to find their own heart.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and let that part that can love awaken again. So.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm making some kind of distinction between, I mean, I laughed when you said that, and you want to make sure that person doesn't give that experience to anyone else. And there's a difference between that kind of basic love. You know, the more you give, the more you're able to give.
Right.
I think.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my own experience, you know, you see that all over. People
mm-hmm.
who can do it can do it.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a difference between that and being, for example, in case people are wondering about this, listening to this, between that and a committed relationship.
Right. Right.
So you don't want that person to give something to everybody else. What is it?
Well, I think that, you know, to make that distinction,
mm-hmm.
for one thing, the love that you're talking about that multiplies when you give it away,
mm-hmm.
that's the beautiful thing about it, is it's the one thing that grows when
yes,
you give it away.
Yes.
You have more.
That's right.
And that we could call universal love or divine love or unconditional love. I think the way that plays out in relationship is that in committed partnership, you're doing a different kind of a dance. And yet, if it's rooted in universal love, then it's going to be at its best. But in that, then you make a commitment to one another that you are not going to, whatever your contract is with each other.
So that's the difference, contract.
Yeah, I think it's out of the love for one another, we say, how can I honor you by giving you a sense of safety and security and stability in this relationship? And if you tell me that you wouldn't like it if I ran off with somebody else, then I'm not going to do that, even if I'm drawn to do it at some point in life. So, but that's coming out of a higher love. You know?
Yes, I have a friend who once said, I would never, never, never do anything that would jeopardize what I have with my wife. That's more important to me than anything.
Well, that's a very evolved recognition, you know, because that's when you're able to... One of my friends put it this way. She said, it's like having the ability to have a fast forward button in your mind.
Oh, good.
In other words, you see, oh, this is going to be great, but what's it going to feel like tomorrow, you know? And how's it going to affect it when my partner finds out? And how am I going to feel about that? And how is that going to rupture the bond that we have, which is built on trust?
So that's a totally different subject than what you're talking about, but nice to keep in mind.
Yeah, I think they're all interrelated. And I talk about things like that in the book. But yeah, I think it's, you know, so when we're dealing with people who are grieving over the loss of someone they love, we're really talking about how to find that place of love inside themselves. They can use their treasured memories. They can sit and look at a photograph of that person. Sometimes, you know, we used to have this concept in the culture that it would be better to not remember.
Oh, that was awful.
It was a bad idea.
Yes, awful. Just pathetic. God bless the 50s. Yes.
Right.
Oh.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Someone dies, and the next day you move all of their clothes out of the house and take away all the pictures.
Or you don't ever talk about something again.
Right,
awful.
Yeah. So I think that if we look at all of these experiences and all our relationships as a search for love, and we recognize that the love we're searching for is inside ourselves, then when we're grieving, we're basically in need of a new way to access that same place.
Oh, so I have a question then. When you... talk about when we're grieving, then we've lost something in ourselves. There's another loss somehow.
Well, not really.
No?
We've lost something in our minds.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And because the mind is saying, I can't have that love, I can't have that joy without this person being present.
Uh-huh.
And it'll be different.
Yes.
I think that, you know, in a way, I would almost say you've gained something in a loss, because you've gained, for many people, the recognition of how precious life is. And that there's an attendant sadness with that, because you start to realize all the opportunities that were missed.
So when you talk about healing all relationships...
I know that's an audacious comment.
Well, it's broad. It's broad. So what I want to know is... how do you do that? I mean, there is, to you, not such a thing as a relationship that cannot be healed, that has to be let go, or is that healing it, letting it go?
Sometimes that's healing it. But
okay.
I think that if that you heal it in that way by bringing forgiveness into the situation. That forgiveness, you know, it's an interesting thing. We're confused about forgiveness.
I think so.
That forgiveness does not mean that we're condoning acts of unkindness or cruelty or dishonesty. Forgiveness doesn't mean that we have to associate with someone who has harmed us. But forgiveness means that we let go of the resentment that is blocking our own ability to feel our own loving heart. It's really, it's an interesting thing.
That's
know?
Really important, that forgiveness being somehow just not dwelling on it anymore.
Right. Letting it go. Letting the resentment go. Knowing that if you feel you need to protect yourself in order to love yourself, you have to make sure you don't interact with this person again because they're violent or they're dangerous or they're just psychologically abusive or they're dishonest, whatever it is. You know, I mean, there are people like that.
So you're not burdening yourself with the misery of it anymore.
Right. And not,
that's nice.
Also not being at odds with the world, mm-hmm. in terms of, you know, I think that we look at the world whenever the words, this shouldn't be, this shouldn't have happened, or this is wrong, mm-hmm. when those arise in our minds, we have a problem.
Yes.
Because we're looking at the world, you know, the world is full of
yes.
strange people.
Yes. And horrible things.
And yes. horrible things, yeah.
There was a movie once, a young woman who had been raped.
Mm.
And she'd been mute since the
mm-hmm.
rape. And, oh, God, it's just this, when I think about it, I still want to just cry. She finally spoke.
Mm-hmm.
And she kept saying, he shouldn't have done that to me. He shouldn't mm-hmm. have, and she kept going. And finally, you know, he just put his arm around her and very simply said, but he did, honey.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
That
right.
being able to know that something horrible can happen,
mm-hmm.
and you're okay.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so nice listening to you about this.
Well, let
me ask you something. If you were right now, which I'd like you to do, because I do think that every human encounter has the seeds of a love letter to someone, who would you write your love letter to right now? Who will you write it to when you go home?
I'd like to write one to you.
That's so sweet of you.
And making such a nice opportunity to visit this morning.
Well, I'm gonna let you go with that because I tend to say I don't want to be in the love letter police. What would you like to say in this?
I would say thank you for doing something for humanity that focuses on the one thing that is the only thing that ultimately makes us happy, and that's love. And by recognizing that we should express that love when we have the opportunity. Because the thing that I've seen when someone dies suddenly,
mm-hmm.
even if they die over the period of a protracted illness, but especially when someone dies suddenly, and that can happen to any one of us at any moment,
mm-hmm.
the greatest grief is I didn't tell them I love them.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
So we've just met, but I love you. And thank you so much for this wonderful opportunity.
Thank you for saying that. I want to ask another couple of questions, if I may, because as you were talking, of course, I could see a whole bunch of love letters.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm big on...
That you would write?
No, that you would write.
Oh, okay.
Yes, that I would write also, and if you don't, maybe I will.
Okay.
Norman Vincent Peale.
Sure, yeah.
To write a love letter to him. Now,
mm-hmm.
writing to people who are no longer here is a lovely thing to do.
Oh, I always recommend that. It's a wonderful thing to do. Yeah.
Do you do this with people?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So where would you send it? Because I like people to be aware of this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. I usually tell people whatever it is that feels right to them. They
mm-hmm.
may write the letter and hang on to it, put it someplace special in the house. I always like to recommend that if someone has died, they keep a special place of honor in the home with photographs and a
mm-hmm.
few mementos and maybe have a candle there and bring some fresh flowers once in a while and sit down and talk to that person. And maybe that's where they put the letter. And maybe they just take it to, if this person is in the cemetery, they'd like to place it on the grave
mm-hmm.
or in the mausoleum crypt or whatever. Whatever feels right. And sometimes you can change. Well, you might like to keep it for a while and then maybe go through a process of letting it go by putting it in a fire of purification.
Well, you know, you're touching on something that I haven't said in a long time, but I am big on it and very firmly believe this and get a lot of joy out of it. When it comes to love letters, you're the boss.
Right.
Whatever you say goes. I do think there's something extra lovely about mailing it to someone.
Mm-hmm.
And so even if you keep it in that special place, if you write it to yourself
mm-hmm.
about someone who's gone,
mm-hmm.
you know, dear grandma, I'm writing this to you, but I'm going to send it to myself
mm-hmm.
so I can remind myself forever
right.
how I feel. I think it's wonderful to see it come in the mail.
Sure.
With some kind
great
of lovely
idea.
And people will find this generations down the line.
Right.
And right. know something valuable about you.
Mm-hmm.
And that is how capable you were, not only of loving,
mm-hmm.
but of expressing it.
Mm-hmm. You know, and writing a handwritten letter.
Oh, yes.
Oh, my goodness. That is almost a lost art in our culture. And I just made a new friend who lives over in Walnut Creek. And this man is about my age. I'm 60. Mm-hmm. He writes handwritten letters. And it's such a treat to get them.
Well, and that's one of the things that I insist on, if I can.
Uh-huh.
Your handwriting. Handwriting is just gold.
Yeah.
And it says so much about you. By the way, it also is a clue as to how you're feeling. Handwriting changes depending on your mood.
Right.
It can be a little cramped. It can be expansive.
Mm-hmm.
It also, in generations from now, you can tell what decade a person learned to handwrite.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard something recently that both touched and chilled me. And that is that at a friend of hers, actually, son's school, they are no longer teaching cursive writing.
Right.
You've heard of this?
I've heard this across the country. This
oh,
is
really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Awful. Well, anyway, because it's like a thumbprint. You wouldn't scrape off people's thumbprints.
Right.
Okay. I'm getting hysterical. But the point is, she told her son, if you learn to do handwriting, you will be able to read the secret thoughts of grown-ups.
Mm.
And that boy was on board.
He was on it right away.
But you can read more, actually, come to think of it, can't you, than just what the words say. They're handwriting experts.
Right.
Aren't we going to lose a huge field of an entrance into a person's heart and mind? We can't analyze what's done on a word processor.
Absolutely. Oh. And everybody knows the problem of misinterpreting emails.
Oh,
because we've lost sight of the fact that communication is so much about body language,
yes,
about facial expression,
yes,
about tone of voice. There's a music to our voices.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can't see that, if you can't hear it, all you're seeing is words on a screen. It's a whole different ballgame.
Yes, it is.
And it's not real. I don't think of it as real communication.
How do you think of it?
Oh, I think of it as sort of a technological tool for keeping in touch, mm-hmm, and having quick sharing of information.
You get to share yours quickly.
Right.
But then you've got to wait for the response. I see it as a painfully slow telephone conversation. I do. It's like,
well, what's amazing to me is how many young people prefer to use the text function on their phone than to actually talk on the phone.
I know. And by the way, I read an article in the newspaper the other day that thousands of these people who are, I say these people because I don't happen to text, because I had to draw the line somewhere.
Yeah.
And the people are deciding to send letters again. They're buying cards, and there are whole industries of people, new people who are manufacturing beautiful cards,
mm-hmm,
because texters want something deeper.
Isn't that interesting?
And more intimate.
Wonderful.
The people who have been texting in particular.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so good for you, texters. Texting is okay for certain things.
Yeah.
That urgency and spurt, and you're taking off on an airplane and you want to say, I can't stand another minute without you.
Right.
Perfect.
Beautiful.
But then, yes.
Yeah. But well, then it's, you know, somehow we have to get back to real heart-to-heart communication.
Exactly. And that comes through the handwriting somehow. It does. Well, I want to thank you so much for doing this with me. It's been so interesting hearing you.
Thank you for inviting me. It's been wonderful talking with you.
Thank you. And this is Janet Gallen saying goodbye for now. And I just want to remind you once again that if you think you need to wait for a special occasion to write a love letter, that writing a love letter is a special occasion. So this is Janet Gallen saying goodbye for now.